This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, here we are. It is the concluding episode of our four-part series of episodes into Arizona history, batting cleanup with us. Jack August, historian, very appropriate. By the way, if you want to get a look at or listen to, if you missed any of them, you can scroll through KTAR.com, click on podcast. You'll be able to find a couple of the most recent, but all of them are archived at MikeO'Neill.org. You click on radio and they're all there. We had three earlier guests in this sequence, a kickoff by Marshall Trimble, Arizona State historian and troubadour. We then interviewed Dick Mallory, the most important man in Arizona history that you probably never heard of. And number three, Fife Symington. But the best of all, Jack August is with us today.
Great to be here, Mike.
So tell us about, we started with Marshall Trimble. Tell us a little about your history with him and fits into the scheme of things here.
Wait, historians are talking history of each other. This is going to get interesting. This is going to be some mind stuff here.
Yeah. I know. Well, Marshall, I may have a different view of Marshall's place in what historians call historiography or the history of writing history. Marshall's a great storyteller. And he makes a discipline that a lot of people at first glance think, oh, God, I got to memorize names and dates and facts and all this stuff. I think that's people's interaction through grammar school and, high school.
Carl Sagan of Arizona history.
Yes. And he's a great storyteller. And he makes history accessible. He makes it fun. He makes it entertaining. The fact that he's a musician and can play off that kind of stuff is good. So I think he's good. He popularizes a discipline that's, I think, important not only for historians and academics, but for attorneys. Attorneys need to have a sense of history because they base a lot of their arguments on precedent. At least I hope so. So the historians and lawyers, we're kind of distant
unless
cousins.
Unless it's like Bush v. Gore and they don't want a precedent. They're embarrassed by what they did and they say, okay, this doesn't
count. Here we go. Arizona, Doc. Arizona.
Oh, he primed me there with precedent
Arizona.
And legal things.
Primed
yes.
you.
But no, but Marsh, you know, he talks about Ash Fork where he's from and the day somebody killed Santa Claus back in the 30s.
We talked
about that. It's fabulous. And so he really has fun with it. And he's probably created a few serious historians in his life. So my hat's off to him.
Yeah. A more serious version of history, Dick Mallory, behind the scenes on just about every significant thing that's happened in this state over the last 50 years.
Yeah, I think so. Dick is the man behind the curtain in a lot of ways. And Stellan Wilmer, among many of the top firms, one of the more influential legal institutions in the history of the state. But Dick has been a transactional attorney. I think he's in real estate and transactional attorney. He makes things happen, and he does a lot of stuff. He does a lot of activities that bring the private sector, the nonprofit, and the public sector together. Like, say, his work behind the scenes with getting the downtown Herberger Theater back in the 80s. That was one of the first steps, if not the first step, in what we're seeing in downtown Phoenix, which is kind of a revitalization or renaissance of the area. There's now the IGC and TGen campus, the biomedical campus, I should say, the opening of the day of the new UVA Cancer Center and Dignity Health, ASU downtown, and the rise just north of Arizona Republic and Channel 12 down there is the rise of the Arizona Center for Law and Society, which will house the Sandra Day O'Connor Law School, Center for Law at ASU, and it's a beautiful building. I can already tell from the outlines of it. So a lot's going on, and Dick's behind in many ways helping that happen.
And going back for a long ways, I remember pointing out to him, I said, you know, Phoenix 40, this seminal group in Arizona history, when this thing gets founded, it's a bunch of 60-something-year-old white men, all of them white, all of them men.
Yes.
And except for him, I said, and you're in your 20s. He corrected me. He said, I was 30.
Yeah, he was 30. Yeah. It was he and a guy named...
3-0.
he and a guy named Bill Shover were talking about their bosses back in the day from roughly 1940.
Bill Shover was the public relations director for the Arizona Republic, but that vastly understates what his influence was in this town.
Exactly right. He's another Dick Mallory-like guy, and they were good friends, and it's not surprising that they were. They worked different sides of the coin, if you will, but pretty much the same coin. But what the Phoenix 40, getting back to that, between 1940 and, say, 1970, the town was run by the big three, as they say, and this is really simplifying it, but there was Walter Bimson, Eugene Pulliam, and Frank Snell of Snell and Will.
Bank, law, and the newspaper.
Newspaper, right. And nothing got done without their nod of approval. Dick and Bill Shover back in 1975, I believe. That's when Governor Castro was governor. He was an ex officio member of the Phoenix 40. They got together and said, we need some new blood. A letter went out and said, this is going to be one of the most important letters you'll ever receive. And I think Pulliam sent the letter. And so they met out at the, if I'm not mistaken, the Camelback Inn. It could have been the Biltmore, and thus the birth of the Phoenix 40, of 40 leading citizens from, for the most part, the north side of Phoenix.
Now, one of the things I most remember about that interview, and this suggested to me that Dick Mallory is still a player. I hit him with a John Talton quote about how this group, which has morphed into Greater Phoenix Leadership, it's sort of the same folks. They once ran this town, and I forget the exact phrase, but essentially they're now toothless and ineffective, and asked him to respond to that, and he kind of parried the question.
Well, that's Dick. Dick is still, in his mind, in the minds of many, including my mind, he's still a relevant player in Phoenix and Arizona activities.
Not bad for 78.
Yeah, and he's as ambitious as he's like 35. A lot of those attorneys downtown seem to be, even though they're 70 and 75, it's like they're as ambitious as they were when they were 30 and young associates in the firm.
Well, it helps when they don't have to write the legal briefs. They just make stuff happen.
They turn it over to an associate. Yeah.
They've earned it, though. At one point, they would have done all that, but they've earned the right to show up with a cup of coffee and say, this is what I want to have done today.
That's correct. You got it down. You know.
As you pointed out, his forte was never law per se. It was a lawyer who made things happen.
I think the last time Dick, and he may jump on me for this if he hears this, but I think the last time he was in court was when he had some traffic tickets and he was kind of nervous about it. But the judge said, Mr. Mallory, it's an honor to see you.
That's a pretty good start.
Yeah.
That works out. We're here with Jack August batting cleanup in our tour of Arizona history over the last 4 weeks. More coming up on The Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back.
Hit that one over there. Did you? You waved me up when the music started.
My technical director here.
And you waved me off as I got this. Don't worry. And then you didn't even have your mic on.
You pointed at me.
You're
I thought that meant talk, so I started talking. You failed to point out the other part that I have to push a button to make the microphone
push
live.
Push your own buttons, mister.
We are here with historian Jack August talking about sort of all things Arizona history. We've talked to Marshall Trumbull, the popularizer of history. Mm-hmm. Dick Mallory, the guy who behind the scenes made things happen. Let's talk about Fife Symington, right. Another guy you're writing a book about.
Yeah, well, I think we can announce it. It's pretty far along. In fact, I'm drafting the narrative. I still have a few more what are called oral history interviews to do with some significant people in his life, both business and political and personal. But we're in the writing stages, and a few articles will be out pretty soon out of the larger narrative. And so I'm doing a critical analytical biography. And to Fife Symington's credit, he's been very open, and it's good. It's to have the kind of access and the kind of candor that he's been discussing.
Two extraordinary connections that will probably blow most people's minds about Fife Symington, the childhood friend John Waters.
Yes.
Just to explain, who is John Waters?
John Waters was in 1976 declared by William Burroughs as the Pope of Trash. He's an artist from Baltimore, and with a group of friends began making these these experimental films. Soon they maybe
really scrubbed, out there stuff.
Really yes. out there stuff. Then I think probably the his best known is Pink Flamingos. A little more mainstream was Hairspray. Serial Mom, which I watched the other night, absolutely hilarious. It's a very different turn for Kathleen Turner from the steamy body heat of 1981 to Serial Mom in 1993. She goes around killing people and acts
but
like a mother.
Not exactly the kind of stuff that one associates with Fife Symington.
No, and what happened?
This is a blue blood, straight laced, button down guy.
And then what happened was that they went to the same grammar school, Calvert in Baltimore. Between 1952 and 58. So they're roughly 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and they were best childhood friends. But by that time, John Waters was already doing weird horror houses and puppet shows, and Fife served as his chief assistant.
Until they got shut down by one of the moms.
Yeah.
I mean, great story.
Yeah.
It was,
moms.
It was just too out there even then. They were killing bunnies.
It was really crazy. And I remember Fife said, "This was off the wall." I said, "The puppet shows were off the wall." Well, if you read, John Waters wrote an autobiography, and he describes these puppet shows in greater detail than I have time or page numbers to devote to it. But nevertheless, they are off the wall. And what was that kid thinking? He even wrote up, he told Fife when they talked most recently, he said, "You know, last week I went back to my old house. And a kid was, I looked up at my hotel, my room, not my hotel room, my bedroom, and a kid was on the front lawn, and he said, 'Come over here.' And the kid recognized him, and he said,
'Waters, you know, this is.'"
Yeah, this is John Waters. Yeah. And he's going back to his old childhood home, and the family was there. And he says, "You don't know the kind of weird blank that I thought up in that room." Yeah. The kid just looked at him and ran away.
Yeah, I would. And he's probably still running. So. Now, hold on. What when you're talking about Fife being the head assistant for him, how old were they at this point? When was
They were 7 and 8 years old.
Oh, okay. So they were kids.
They were kids. Yeah. And Mrs. Symington loved Johnny Waters, as they called him. But a lot of the parents kind of were on to his act already. And they didn't quite understand this relationship with the straight lates, kind of the wealthy kid up the street, and John Waters, whose family was pretty well off, by the way, as well.
Yeah, I remember my mom worked with a fella for the government. And he was sort of an attempt to be a comedian. Nobody thought he was funny. Subsequently had a hit TV show, and the guy on Get Smart, would talk to his phone and all that.
Yeah.
And they said he was like that in person. Everybody just kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, he's just weird, but not particularly funny.
Don Adams you're talking?
Don Adams, that was the one. Yep.
Man.
Yeah.
That was the cone of silence.
So we fast forward Fife Symington. Yes. The other thing that, you know, catches a lot of people's attention when it's getting well known, but another teenaged acquaintance, Bill Clinton.
Yes. Well, what happened was that Fife went to a prep school named Gilman in North Baltimore, and his best friend there was a guy named Tommy Kaplan, who was kind of like John Waters, a bit odder than the regular group of guys.
I see a pattern here with Fife.
There's a pattern. Oh, yeah. He felt protective of him.
Okay.
And the kid was – Tommy was very bright. They were editors of the school newspaper. They graduate. Fife goes to Harvard. Tommy Kaplan goes down the street from Baltimore to Georgetown. Kaplan, Clinton, they're put in the same floor, and they quickly become friends. So Fife Symington's best friend, and they remain best friends to this day, became Bill Clinton's best friend in college. And later on, Tommy Kaplan's politics were more like Clinton's than Fife's. That never has stopped. To Fife Symington's credit, that doesn't one's political orientation has nothing to do with his friendships, and nor Clinton's, by the way, as I've learned. And so they become friends, the three of them. And so during their sophomore year in college, there is a summer vacation to Hyannisport. Fife said he had a couple of very attractive cousins, female cousins, and he felt he had to be there to keep kind of block Bill from he's already garnering that reputation, but nevertheless they're up there. There's a lot of alcohol and fun that as college kids do, and they look out in off Hyannisport on the coast, and they see a head bobbing about 200 yards off, getting caught in riptide. It's Bill, and Fife looked down the shoreline, and about 200 yards away was a little dory, he called it, a little rowboat. He rowed out, intercepted him. Clinton was in big trouble. bleeding. His chest was all cut because he went over some coral reefs, and he saved his life.
He told the story about pulling him up by the hair.
Yeah, he had long hair at the time, and he says, and Clinton was a big guy. It was a real challenge to get him up on the boat. He was in desperate trouble. Fast forward beyond that, they go into their political careers in the 90s, but both Clinton had lost the governorship but then won it back. And so they're at the governor's conference in 1991 or 92 in, I think, Washington, Seattle, perhaps. And Bill Clinton walked up to Ann Symington, and the first thing he ever said to her is, "Your husband saved my life." And she went, "What?"
Yeah.
And
it was more memorable to Clinton than it was to Symington.
Yeah, I think he remembered close-death experiences. And as it turned out, the Symington kids and Chelsea all hung out together during that conference. And so they maintained a friendship through Tommy Kaplan. And then the capstone of the story is that later both Clinton and Symington undergo the legal special prosecutor, as it were, and they're both going through legal problems as Fife's 14-week trial is rolling along, which caused him to leave office. He's back in Washington, D.C. with his attorney, John Dowd, and they go to see the Cal Ripken, the game that he broke the record for the longest.
3,000 games in a row, I think. Yeah.
He's in the stands. Clinton and Tommy Kaplan are up in a special place. They send the Secret Service down, and Fife goes up there, and they hug each other. Clinton and Symington hug each other, and the president said, I've been watching your case. It's really wrong with what's going on, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and by the way, it's 2,131. Let's say 3,000. Come on now, Doc. Right. You're giving him super Iron Man status.
We got a sports guy in the crowd.
Super, well, all right, here we're with Jack August. We're walking through basically bat and cleanup, like Doc said earlier. Good job. See, we're doing sports analogies, sports references the whole day. That's how we're going
to
work it.
Oh, more. There's no limit to hackneyed sports analogies.
There you go. All right, coming up next on KTAR News.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
All right, are all your buttons pushed back?
You saw me looking at the buttons. They're all red. I'm live and ready to go.
All right.
We're here with historian Jack August and talking about the curious intersection of the lives of Fife Symington and Bill Clinton.
Right.
Republican governor, Democratic president, but teenage acquaintances.
Yes, and they remained quite friendly through their respective careers. One's trajectory takes them into the presidency. One had an interrupted governorship. What happens is that Fife's trial takes its turn. He's forced to resign office after being found guilty on 7 of 23 counts. But Tommy Kaplan remains a constant, the high school friend and Bill Clinton's friend in the presidency. And so it gets down there, and Fife is ready to go. He has a yellow bag ready to go to prison. I think they were going to sentence him to, I think, 30 months or something.
We talked about that extraordinary story because the human side of it. Yeah, so you got a bag. Tough. He knew that he was on 24-hour notice.
He was.
If the appeal had gone down, if they'd rejected the appeal— He had 24 hours to report to prison.
That's correct. So it was really tough, but he had mentally prepared. He was wanted to work in the kitchen, which is another part of his life, which we will address in the book.
They talked about that. One of the things that an ex-governor gets to do is to call the director of prisons. And he talked about how he called the federal prisons and said, "Listen, I'm going to behave. I'm not going to be any trouble, but I want to work in the kitchen."
Yeah. So it was that close. They were talking kind of practical.
I mean, that's
things.
A kind of it's no longer theoretical at that point.
Exactly.
You're staring at this in the face, and it is hanging over your head.
But he had a great attorney named Terry Lynham that assisted John Dowd. He wrote the appeal. It went 2-1 for Symington, so the Ninth Circuit kind of postpones it.
But that appeal knocked out the conviction, but it sent it back for retrial. It wasn't a statement of innocence. It was a statement, the trial was flawed. You get another shot.
You get another shot, exactly. So it was still up in the air. But then President Clinton let it be known that he would review a pardon, if possible. And so Clinton went out with two sets of pardons in the last days of his office, and Tommy Kaplan walked Terry Lynham's petition for pardon to the White House. It didn't go directly through the DOJ.
That's not the way it's normally done.
No.
These pardons go through a long, elaborate vetting process. This is the back door to the White House.
The back door to the White House on the Wednesday before the Tuesday that he leaves office. It may have been the last pardon that Clinton signed in the last 12 hours of his presidency was Fife Symington's.
And an interesting thing that you pointed out to me once, there was one type of pardon, only three in American history.
Yes, it was a preemptive presidential pardon. One was Richard Nixon's, the other was Caspar Weinberger's, and the third one was Fife Symington's.
And preemptive means you haven't been convicted. Now, Symington was convicted, but the conviction's vacated, so he's no longer convicted.
Right.
He's a guy subject to trial, and he's being pardoned, in effect, before conviction.
Yes, it's really a
just
unique,
isn't done.
Yeah,
normally, you go through the process, you get found guilty. If there's a pardon, it's after the fact. Three times in American history.
Yeah.
Now, the most extraordinary thing to me of that entire interview was after talking about that, I asked him an open-ended question. He had talked about how he thought his prosecution was political, and I asked him just open-ended question: can you think of other instances that come to mind? No lead, no suggestion. And he went immediately to Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And then later to Bill.
Yes, I know.
Those were the only two names he mentioned.
Yeah. That's why doing this biography is so interesting and surprising. People don't really know the Fife Symington, that there's a three-dimensional person there, not a two-dimensional person that, say, the New Times or the Arizona Republic or the Arizona Daily Star painted in the 90s. And that's what's interesting and human about him. And by the way, he's been convicted of nothing. He's a young, vigorous guy still, comparatively. And, he could conceivably, theoretically, run for office. And I tell you, within Republican circles, I am observing that he has a lot of clout and people come to him for advice, including the current governor and previous governor and a lot of the political insiders like Chuck Coughlin and those guys.
You know, my take on it, he would clearly be the establishment wing, though, of the Republican Party.
Yes.
He's not a Tea Party guy.
No.
The Tea Party would probably call him a rhino. They call anybody who's not with them a rhino.
I kind of kid him about that he'd have a tough time getting out of a Republican primary today as opposed to 1990.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, most Republicans, I think, that we painted in that light as the Republican Party sees the Ronald Reagans and things like that, they wouldn't last through a primary. I think
the myth of Ronald Reagan would be different from the reality to common sense Americans.
Yes. That's a compliment.
Yes.
That's a compliment. You wouldn't make it out of a Republican primary. That's a compliment.
Yeah, I think the 80% of the center
thank you.
On both political sides. But then there's those 5 and 10% out there that make a lot of noise. And
This is not new. As a historian, I assume you're familiar with the Hofstadter article, the paranoid style of American politics.
Oh, yeah.
This was written 50 years ago. Want to talk about that?
No, not that. Let's move on.
Yes.
Okay, so.
Yeah, Manny, no, we have plenty of time, Doc. We got plenty of time. Let's get after this. Here's what I want to do.
Okay.
And I've asked this question before, and I think it's interesting to me that if I have guests in from out of town, most of my family's from out of state, so they're from California, what's the one story, if we're all sitting down at a dinner table, what's the one story you're going to, as a historian of the state of Arizona, what's the one story you want to tell them?
Well, it may not surprise anyone that knows me or knows my work, but I would start with water. And people come to Phoenix or Tucson and they go, how is there 5 to 6 million people here and it doesn't rain very often,
right,
at all?
It does.
And where does the water come from? And so I think the big story is water, and it goes it goes back to the 19th century, even from the founding of when Arizona was carved out of New Mexico in 1863, the western half of New Mexico. And how do we somehow acquire and put to beneficial use water in a water scarce and arid state? And I think the big hero of that would be Carl Hayden. He was born in 1877, October 2nd, by the way, and on the south side of the Salt River. He's purportedly the first Anglo child born in that area. He grows up with flood and drought. The flood of 1891 wiped out his family's little ferry business and all that, and then flood in 1905. And so he grew up with the vicissitudes of and changes that water wrought on Arizona and the lack of it. And so From the time that he becomes our first congressman with the special election of 1911, when we become a state, we elect our first congressman. He's congressman at large. He serves from 1911 to 1927 when he unseats a sitting senator named Ralph Cameron. Then from 1927 to 1969, he serves in the Senate. So he put it together. Before that, he was county sheriff. He was Joe Arpaio's predecessor from 1907 to 1912. He never shot anybody, and no one shot at him. Before that, from 1904 to 1906, he was county treasurer and paid people in gold pieces. And then before that, he was on the Tempe Town Council. So he spent 67 years of his 92-year life in public office. And with that, he got seniority. And that seniority, even though he didn't say much, he was known as a silent senator, but he ran all the committees. He ran the Appropriations Committee.
And that
he had
meant
to go
more
through
than
Carl Hayden.
That meant a lot more then than it does now.
It certainly does. And he controlled the purse strings of government. And so what happened was that through his longevity and through the wisdom of the electorate here to keep sending Carl Hayden to office, even in 1962, his last term, Barry Goldwater and the opposing party came out in support of Carl Hayden the day before the election, and much to the chagrin of the Republican nominee named Evan Meekham in 1962.
Why do we all laugh when people say, that's why, yeah.
Yeah, so their paths crossed too, and Ev is another unique American and Arizona story. Another guy pretty well understood, but misunderstood in some ways. But nevertheless, I think Carl Hayden represents continuity and the quest for water. And I think that would be the big Arizona story.
And I think, is it fair to say, I think we do a better job about our water, for example, than California?
I think we do. And you know what? And let's go back to Fife Symington and some of his, I think, very progressive. I don't know if he's going to
like that line here. You're damning him now.
Some progressive environmental policies.
I can see that being, if he runs for office again, I can see that being used against him.
I killed him, yeah.
Exactly.
But he had some very futuristic water resource development policies. And, you know, he hired Rita McGuire. He hired Maria Beyer, who later became our land commissioner. Mm-hmm. He hired very good legal people that understood water and helped him forge good policy. One thing that Fife did after his first 2 years in office, he stumbled around, and he'll be the first to admit it, that there was a couple of missteps and some personnel issues. But he finally gets his footing.
Government's complicated.
Yes, it is. And as I was saying off the air earlier, I said, Fife, we were at dinner, and I said, was running government like a business, like you said it was in the campaign? He goes, blank, no. It's nothing like it. It was a big surprise, and I don't think anyone that runs, I'm going to run government like a business. Yeah, that makes good rhetoric and all that for a campaign, but when you get in there,
good.
It's a different deal.
It sounds good because the image of government is that it's ineffective and whatever, and business is efficient, but yeah, it's a different animal. Do it with a different set of objectives.
Jack August, thanks for being here and batting cleanup for us. We appreciate that. What you are bringing, and we're so excited about this Fife book, by the way. When is this? Give me an estimate. Give me some sort of
I think I could finish in 12 to 18 months, and then it's got to go through peer review and all that stuff.
This is history, right. Not journalism, folks.
All right, come on. You got a deadline. Get on it, boss. All right. So we're talking about maybe 2017 is when we're looking at
like
this?
Yeah, something like that, 2017, 18, right there.
And we look forward to it.
Yeah. Thanks.
We look forward to it. Thank you so much for being here. Doc and I are going to tie a historic bow around this one next.
Thank you.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
I feel like I've been on a four-week ride at Disneyland, and we're pulling into the station, and please keep your hands and arms inside the vehicle until it comes to a complete stop. I feel like we've just been on a fun little ride. It's been a good time.
The fastest part of the ride was at the end. I mean, with Jack, we covered an incredible amount of ground here in rapid fire.
But the cool thing is we covered ground about the people that were covering history the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I think that's what was fun about the whole thing. And I'll tell you, I'm really glad when I asked him about the one story that he wanted to tell. Instead of going with a direct story, he went more with a theme.
Yeah.
And I think that's a theme that pops up in Arizona history over and over and over again, and that's water.
Yeah.
We have such an amazing history with water because that's what I was in real estate for several years, and that was the first question. Anyone moving into town, first question, what about water? Because people see this place and think it's a desert, it's hot, there is no water.
Yeah, and the other guy that he didn't get around to crediting, and we went through this with him in an earlier interview and asked Arizona governors, and,
yes.
and I asked him the question, who do you think's the best? And I thought I knew the answer, but I didn't. I was waiting to hear what it was.
Double B.
Bruce Babbitt.
Bruce
yeah.
Babbitt.
And
yeah.
the reason was water.
Yeah, absolutely.
The reason was that we now have 7 million people here largely because of, it's a whole history. It's Carl Hayden, it's
yeah.
Central Arizona Project. But then it was also Bruce Babbitt and the management of groundwater.
Right, exactly. And that's it. So if you leave your sprinklers on tonight and forget that they're on and kind of flood your yard, thank Bruce Babbitt that you got to do that.
And if you move to California, you can see that they are in a world of hurt
yep.
because they haven't done the same level of management.
Exactly, like we have. And it's an issue of pride. It's a matter of pride. You talk to any of the historians, the people of history that we talked to in the last 4 weeks, and they're very proud of that. And I think as residents of the state of Arizona, that we should all be proud of that as well.
I think there's a lot of stuff we do wrong, but there's one thing that we
yeah.
did very right.
Right, right.
And that was water.
And
that's
a
big thing,
that.
And that's why there's so many of us here.
Right. And what I didn't hear, by the way, and this is something I don't know if this is my wheelhouse, but I don't know if you studied this as well. I think one of the other things that Arizona does right that I didn't hear from our historians was conservation. We do wildlife conservation like darn near no one in this country. We have more animals, more species of animal in the state of Arizona than any non-coastal state in the country. And it's all because we have proper management of that, and that's done, believe it or not, here I am. I know everybody's going to fall over here. I'm giving a tip of the hat to the government about that one.
Well, interesting. I'll yield to you on that one. I did not know that. I'm encouraged to hear that.
Yes. Our Arizona Game and Fish Department is better than any other state in the country.
And you're a hunter, so it makes for a target-rich environment.
It is absolutely wonderful. Now that we're just buried in dove season and quail season and
kill Bambi.
It's so much. No, come on, kill Bambi. Kill Bambi's dad. Anyway, let's move on to this. But what stuck out in those 4 interviews? What stuck out to you the most?
I am still reeling about the Symington comment about Hillary. Especially Hillary and Bill.
But it makes sense now that we know that they're buddies. They're pals. Of course he's going to think, well, they went after my buddies.
Bill.
Okay. All right.
But here's the difference between the comment, and he mentioned Hillary first. It's sort of innocuous to say, I think Bill got persecuted, because he's a past, you know. There's no immediate political consequence to
okay,
that.
Right.
And there is the direct personal tie to him.
Right.
With her, it's more a derivative tie, and we're talking about current stuff.
The kids playing together, the things like that. Yeah. There's a connection between the Symington and Clinton family, and I'm not saying that Fife is becoming a left winger. I'm just saying that they're friends. And like Jack August mentioned, this wasn't about politics. It was about being friends.
But it's also about somebody who went through prosecution
Agreed.
That he saw as politically motivated. And the question I asked him was, can you think of other instances like that?
I think if you ask the other side of the ball, I think you get the same answer. I think if you ask the Clintons the same thing, I think if they would have a list, because they've seen a lot more of this on a national level. But I'm almost positive you would find, now that I know their story, you would find Symington in that
but
list.
But it's interesting because this occurred under his presidency, and that tells you that the operation of the Justice Department under Clinton was really hands-off.
And
that he wasn't directing it because he didn't like what his own Justice Department was doing.
Agreed. And I would say this, though, that what I think I learned today, which was absolutely fascinating to me, was this preemptive pardon nonsense.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of silly, yet really cool, because it's only happened a few times.
Three times.
So that's
extraordinary.
It.
And I think, obviously, Clinton was thinking, you know, I'm leaving office.
Right.
It's
got to help my guy
now
out
or not.
Here. Right.
If he had another 4 years, I think he would have let it ride out, let it go through the legal process.
Right.
And consider it on the back end.
But that's absolutely fascinating that could actually happen.
Yeah.
Not even convicted. Let's just.
Well, this has been tested. The power of the president to pardon is virtually limitless. It's one of the few areas in the Constitution where there really is unchecked power, though in a way the pardoning power is a check itself.
Yes.
It's one check against the possibility of a runaway government.
Mm-hmm.
And it is used generally
so infrequently because it's political bombshell stuff.
Until the very end of your term. Week of pardons on your as you're packing your bags.
Last week, usually the last night. Usually it's like midnight. You know, you're out of office at noon, and you sign these things after midnight. Yeah. You put them in an envelope. You get on the helicopter. You leave town, and then it hits the press.
Exactly. Friday before a holiday weekend.
Yeah, well, that's the other place you do stuff. That's the classic thing about when you issue in politics bad news.
Sure.
Friday afternoon, after the papers have gone to press, and you know they print the Saturday paper, it's too late for that, and the Sunday paper's already half printed on Wednesday. So it has the whole weekend to percolate. Oh, and by the way, a lot of the interviews on the Sunday talk shows are taped on Friday night. So,
sure.
So, you know, it is the moment you have to bury something that you think you would just as soon never saw the light of day.
And pardons would be in there. Yeah. I would definitely say.
Yeah, because it's always touchy. Because in effect, what you're saying is the justice system went through a process and it convicted somebody. You got an indictment, you got a jury to say convicted, you got a whole lot of appeals, it exhausts the appeals, and now you, the president or the governor, same power essentially, is saying, nope.
No,
that's wrong.
I didn't like that.
And you don't have to state a reason.
No, you don't. Because you're the president. You're the boss.
You just say this pardon is executed.
Yes. So how many did W pardon? Trivia question.
I don't know.
One.
It was only one.
That was it.
Wow.
One. And it wasn't his buddy either. Yeah. So it was, I always found
that tells you how rare
Say what you will about W, with R's and D's and all of this. Yeah. I actually respected that about him. He had one that bothered him instead of the hundreds that we've seen in past presidents, including the Reagans, the Clintons, and everybody.
A lot of the speculation right now at the end of the Obama presidency is we have a prison system that is bursting at the seam with a lot of people who have been convicted on low-level drug stuff.
Yeah.
You know, life sentence for marijuana and things like that.
Right.
There is speculation as to whether or not at the end of the Obama presidency there might be mass pardons for a whole class of people who got serious jail time for stuff that would not get that kind of time right now.
I'm going to shock you. Not against that one bit.
Well,
that would be one thing that I would celebrate President Obama if he were to do, because it's a bunch of nonsense.
What would be a
departure
is in the past, pardons have only been directed at individuals. I'm talking about directing at a whole class of individuals who were prosecuted for stuff that we now regard as a whole lot less serious.
Absolutely. Right. In times change. Yeah. And times change. And our times here in Arizona have changed. And going through these 4 weeks, it just it fills me with more pride that Arizona, you know what? We've had a fun rocky road, and here we are. We're still thriving.
Certainly, no shortage of interesting stories in the Grand Canyon.
We didn't get to Meekum. Oh man, I tell you,
we got some for next week.
Okay, all right, very good. On behalf of Doc O'Neill and all of the wonderful people here at KTAR News, I'm Mike Russell. Thanks for spending some time with us right here in the Think Tank.